And welcome to a Halloween edition of Pod Stallions. As always, I am Brian, and to my left, way over there in the corner, is Jason.
Good evening.
Oh, good evening. Where does that blah come from?
Look at that.
The kids asked me that recently.
I don't know. I know that it's definitely ripping on Legoski,
mm-hmm.
and he's blah, good evening, blah.
Is it like
somebody
Looney
must
Tunes?
Have taken? I think it's like somebody took. Somebody took, you know, boo or woo, like something, and then turned it into blip.
Yeah.
Like that's the scary thing that he says almost.
Blah, blah, blah.
You know, yeah. It's brilliant. I've thought of that myself, like where and when did it sort of happen?
Yeah, in those pre-internet days.
Yes, back when we had to make things up.
Yeah, so
make up
like
our own
play
fun.
It again, Sam, was never actually a line in Casablanca.
That's right. Allegedly, neither was... Beam me up, Scotty.
No, come on.
That was never right. No, I'm serious. It was always like beam us up, Scotty, or Scotty beam us mm-hmm. up, or I don't know if beam me up, Scotty was ever
a thing,
a thing that was used in the show. It was variations on that, but I don't think they ever said beam me up, Scotty.
That's neat. I never thought of that. So
yeah.
Speaking of Star,
I could be wrong.
Speaking
and I'm
of
sure,
Star Trek,
I'm sure we'll get letters. If
yeah,
I,
yeah, you'll get turgid letters. Speaking of Star Trek. Well, this is the worst segue ever. We thought for Halloween, and I think somebody suggested that we do a follow-up to our Hammer episode, which seemed very well received, and we're going to cover Amicus Films, which is often Woo-hoo. Mistaken for Hammer movies, and rightfully so. Both filmed in England, both share the same stars, but there is a different tonal shift to those. But
I'm going to say, before yeah. we even get into it, because you know much more about this topic than I do, but I'm going to say one of the things that I would say makes it different. I think Amicus is much darker, much more graphic, and much darker than Hammer. I feel like they push the envelope further a lot
Actually,
of the time.
Yeah,
am I wrong?
I think
with
their portmanteau films, they're kind of sillier. And
there's a lot more comedy
yeah.
too. Yes, that's for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
but
actually,
I think the graphic, the limbs coming off and.
I think it's a bit of a wash. Like, I just mean that there's a tonal difference. And Sabowski didn't like showing all the blood and gore, but you're right. There's some real dark, suggestive matter in those films. You're absolutely right. I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah, and a lot of limbs getting cut off, and you know, it's more not gory, but you're right. It's more not necessarily the
yeah.
blood as it is, you know, dismembered body parts and you know. Weirdness like that seemed to go a little
yeah,
further.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it's funny you say that. I always think of them as goofy, but there is some real darkness in them too, so.
Well, I think it probably, the goofy kind of offsets the, you know, what's the one where the guy, because I remember this, I briefed myself a little bit, but I do remember this one. I don't know if it was an anthology, but where the guy cuts up the wife into pieces.
Yeah, that's a Tales from the Crypt. Oh, no, sorry. There's a couple. We'll get into them, but
yeah. But that's like really holy
yeah.
crap territory.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? But yeah. So we thought Amicus would be a fun companion to the Hammer one. And tell us a little bit about. Isn't some of it was kind of born out of Hammer, kind of.
Well, Amicus? It's a British film company. It's run by two Americans. Based at Shepperton Studios in England. So, you know, there's some similarities in that and the fact that they used a lot of the same people. I always think of these guys as they were just capitalizing on what was popular. Because their first few films are like I've never seen either of these films. I'm reading this offline, but they made a couple of low budget teen films, musicals, and
yeah, one of them was who was in one of them? One was like was it Alan Freed or somebody? Weren't they in one of them?
Oh, I don't even know. I've never heard of these films because like they're not really in my wheelhouse of you know. I don't really watch a lot of. A lot of those kind of movies, you know, beach party, right. You know, right. Beach party accepted,
right?
You know, so I haven't seen either of them, but they're called "It's a Trad Dad," which I don't know what that means.
Oh, right.
And Just for Fun. Yeah. So, but the beauty of Amicus Films, they're actually one of my favorite film houses because they made a lot of horror and a lot of science fiction, and of course. Very near and dear to our hearts, they even did some Edgar Rice Burroughs.
That's right. And something else we love, we'll get to.
Yeah, absolutely. So they basically started with the first horror film they made is called Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. And I could see a lot of people thinking that is a Hammer film because it stars Cushing and Lee.
That's the one, that's the, they get on a train car. Yeah, I remember that one.
You know
very
what?
Well.
Actually, I'll let you, because I realized recently, I've never seen it. Or if I haven't, I was, you know, very tired and or drunk. But I do not remember this one at all. And I really want to see it now.
I remember bits of it. I remember the Lee one, because again, I think that's a very graphic one with a, you know, disembodied limb or something.
And
Cushing, I think Cushing is kind of doing an accent. I don't know who he's supposed to be, but it really kind of, didn't it sort of set the template for those kind of anthology things that we got more of?
The name is called Portmanteau, but yeah, you and I would say anthology or Twilight Zone.
Yeah, I think that, well, and again, I could be, again, I did a very brief sort of overlook, but when I think of Portmanteau, there's a movie called Dead of Night. I think it's called Dead of Night, which was, I forget who directed it, but it is one of the greatest horror movies of all time. And it is a car pulling up to a house, getting in the house with a room full of people. And the person starts to say, you know, I've had the strangest dream. I feel like, well, you were there, and mm-hmm. you were there, and we're standing here, and they start to tell stories, and it's a really, really cool. I mean, it's got to be mid-50s, late-50s, and the thing that everybody knows it for is the final story that has to do with the ventriloquist and his dummy, and it is still to this day one of the scariest scenes and sequences in a movie, and I think Barrymore, one of the Barrymores is the lead in that ventriloquist one. But that you know, I think this stuff started to kind of get influenced by that portmanteau, that those stories. Also, again, slight side note, but when I hear, what's it called? Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. Did you ever see the Steve Coogan?
Yes.
Comedy series that was kind of an homage. It was called Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I haven't seen it in ages, and I'd like to look it up again.
It's very hit or miss. Mm. There are a couple that are great and some that are just too...
Well, talk about a niche comedy show. You know?
Right?
You're never... That you have to know what you're looking at. And, you know, how many people are there? Like, what's our audience? To do a broadcast television show making fun of Amicus Films is
and what's great is there's one that is very much an Amicus, and it's in an elevator, and Coogan is in every one of them. The most interesting thing about it is Coogan doing these completely different characters in each one. Some are much more broad, but Coogan's in it. Mark Gatiss is in one. Simon Pegg is in one. All these guys that love this stuff, you can see where the love comes from. But the best thing about it, really, and it's the briefest, is him introducing and closing each episode as Dr. Carroll in this amazing old man makeup, and it's brilliant. But so every time I think of that title now, The Amicus, I think of Dr. Terrible's House of Horror.
Yeah, it's definitely a great homage. And, you know, I want to just point out that these films all kind of have the same look that I love, and but be it adventure or horror, there's just something about them. They're just, they have this wonderful Saturday matinee look to them. I don't know if that makes any sense.
How do you, when you say, well, what do you mean? What kind of a look? You mean just the lighting, or just the feel, the
lighting, the
graininess
the sound,
of the footage, or what?
The editing, it just kind of works for me. You know, I absolutely adore these films, and I don't think there's many that I find bad or unwatchable.
Yeah, I think you and I, we've texted about this before. I think you and I have this very similar sort of fetish, of the many fetishes we share.
Many, many.
Very similar
Some
sort of fetish
share.
To when we come across, you know, a British show that isn't Doctor Who or something, and we just love the film sequences, and then the studio
stuff, and the
creepy
sets.
And there's a feel to these movies that is very... You know, sometimes the sound effects are much louder than they need to be, like all the Foley stuff. But there's something really, really appealing. It's very specific.
Yeah. Amicus' music is always a huge favorite of mine. So I have not seen Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, and I will get right on that. But it has an amazing cast. Donald Sutherland, Michael Gow, who I think we discussed in the last film, or the last podcast.
Yeah.
Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee. Like, this is gold. And what I read recently about I watched a documentary on Amicus a while ago, like maybe 2 years ago. Did I give it to you after? I can't remember.
Gave me a UFO one.
Okay, I was supposed to give you an Amicus documentary. I didn't do it. What I read is it was easy to get people to make these, because it wasn't a long tie-up for work. Like, they didn't pay a lot, but it was usually a week's work to do a portmanteau, because you were only doing a 20-minute sequence out of the film. And that's how they ended up with these people like Donald Pleasance and you know, Barry Morse, and just, you could get this kind of caliber of actor, because Herbert Lom was in one, because you can just, they would be in and out, you know, in between things.
And it also must have been, I mean, it must have been a time where, because we're talking, what, mid-60s?
That was their first horror, and that was mid-60s, yeah.
Mid-60s. So at that stage, the Hammer stuff was pretty big and popular.
Yeah.
So they must have also known, like, look, I can only do it for a day or two, that's fine. But also, this is going to be a big film. This is going to get a lot of people, you know, seeing my work or whatever, I don't know, but... But I think we kind of forget just how big what a big movement this was for these horror movies.
Absolutely, absolutely. And
you know why people would do it.
Unfortunately, that was like they took a while before they did another portmanteau. But their next film was very much like Hammer. They jumped on a BBC TV serial and made a color film of it. It's another Doctor. It's Doctor Who and the Daleks, which they got. You know, they got the rights for the story. I don't think they got all the rights, because Doctor Who became something of a earthbound character played by Peter Cushing, as we both know. And what do you think of the Amicus, which I think they use the production called Aru for these films. I don't know if that was like a limited partnership or what, but.
I love them for what they are. I don't think I've ever sat through both of them more than just a few times.
Yeah, maybe. That was the
thing.
The
fact that Peter Cushing, this guy, you know, because in 1977 when Star Wars came out, I'm not sure if either of us really were that familiar with who Peter Cushing was.
No, not at all.
And we got more familiar.
Yeah,
and then to find him in these horror things, and then one day find out that he was playing the Doctor. And then it was like, wait, what is this thing? I mean, you can count on one hand the number of current TV series that got made into a feature, not the ones that sort of got edited together, like what was that one, Flintstone Go Home, or like the Uncle ones.
Well, it was
whatever.
Much more prominent, like, in the UK because of black and white versus color, like we talked about with the Man right, from U.N.C.L.E. films.
We were talking about the Man from U.N.C.L.E. and on the buses you mentioned, like that was a current thing that became a
on
movie.
The buses,
and
there were some other ones, like the Quatermass films.
The Quatermass ones.
I want to say, but it wouldn't be Carry On, but there's probably a lot more British programs we're not even thinking about that got into, that became features.
And then you kind of, don't have anything until, you know, the X-Files movie. Like that, when that X-Files movie happened, when it was in between seasons, that was incredibly rare for a hit show that was still on the
air.
Yeah,
you didn't do that. You're right.
You just didn't do it.
Well, Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me, you know, was sort of that.
Yeah, you could throw that. I mean, it's a couple years later, but you could throw that in there for sure. So it's a really weird sort of genre anyway that kind of thing exists. And the fact
that... Well, I think Daleks were so popular... And there was no VCRs, so they caught up, and it obviously was a huge hit because they made a sequel. But, you know, you were saying that I love those films, but I think I used to own at least one of them on DVD, and it was like, oh, I can't sit through these. Because they're
yeah, it's the second one that I have a harder time
with. The first one's pretty, but it's a bit of a slog. Not that it isn't well made, it's just... It is what it is. I do have both the films. They're not available anymore, but Riff Trax did both the films. And the first one, Riff Trax really knocked out of the park. But then...
I'm sure they did.
It was well done. But unfortunately, whoever owns the rights to these things is all over the map, and Riff Trax lost the rights to them.
Well, I'll give you a little... a little inside info. Because, you know, when we lost the BBC license, which was through nothing that we did, you know, for making toys, we did very, very well with those, and they were very successful. They were changing things around. They had some big umbrella that was done, and, you know, our company, along with others, sort of got pushed out, whatever. Not holding a grudge. But years later, someone contacted us about, like, well, we've got the movie. And but it was very, very specific. First of all, they thought that they had Star Wars with these two Doctor Who and the Dalek films, whoever had this license. Secondly, you still had to get some kind of a separate license for the word Dalek or the name or something. It was really specific what could be used and whether you could even use the words Doctor Who, or you certainly couldn't use Cushing's image. So really strange. And then, of course, it was like they wanted $1 million kind of thing. And it was like, okay, you guys don't. But it's been a headache for a long time, I know, with those rights. And I think the DVDs are out of print.
Yeah, do you remember that Daleks showed up, I think, and I didn't find this out until like 16 or 17 years later when I had kids, in Space Jam? They just kind of show up in Space Jam?
I thought it was the Looney Tunes one.
Oh, you know what? You could be right. It's in the Looney Tunes movie, and I was told that was due to the fact that hand in the distribution of the film.
I think there's some sequence with a bunch of different creatures or robots and things like that walking around a museum.
Yeah, and there's an old school Dalek.
And all of a sudden, an old school movie Dalek, you know, shows up. But think of what that must have been like. So, like you said, black and white, small screen.
Yeah.
Watching the show, and people were, and all of a sudden, this big budget, which to them seemed like a big budget color movie, with these monsters, these Daleks that were big monsters on TV, and now suddenly in color, and they were all different colors,
and that got
there were different
that got,
ranks
that, got that got released in the United States, and it got merch. It got a Dell
in the United States.
Yeah, Dell Comics did the official adaptation.
Oh, that's right.
And I used to own that, and I wish I still did. But I do have the U.S. novel, which is hilarious looking. It's three Dalek toys with sparklers in their heads, and just three people quivering, and it's like, you know,
those are the. The vacuum form, like the I don't think they're the marks even. I think they're the ones that have those tiny little eggs on the side. You know, like the, you know how the bumpers on the outside, like they're tiny.
Yeah.
And it was like a vacuum form, almost like a baby toy almost. And they're on. It's on the cover with some kind of different colored lighting, hitting it from the front. But isn't that fascinating that got some kind of merchandise? A decade before. The show really hit in America when things started to kick off.
Good, in the late 70s. A good solid decade, yeah.
You know, Product Enterprise did a did a remote control movie Dalek, and they did something that was amazing to me. What an achievement! They got Cushing, artwork of Cushing on the box.
Wow!
And that's the only thing I think has ever been made with his likeness. And remember, I told you years ago that the guy that ran Product Enterprise sent me a stack of prints because they took the guy that did the artwork for those. He was like a movie poster guy. Did Evil Dead 2, you know, subway poster in the UK and stuff. Had him do the artwork on all their boxes, and they sent me prints from an art show. So I've got that hammer one that I sent you a picture of with the hammer in the middle, and then all the creatures, you know, around the hammer with blood coming off of it.
Yeah.
And they sent me the Cushing one. So it's basically the original, you know, the artwork that would have been on the packaging for that remote control Dalek. And that's about the only thing I think Cushing has ever been on. God knows how they did it, but they did it. But so the science fiction thing was kind of big then too, and
yeah.
they jumped on that, and those were pretty popular movies, weren't they?
Yeah, like they 1965 they did Doctor Who and the Daleks, then they did a film called The Skull, another horror film, which is about the skull of the Marquis de Sade, and it stars Cushing and Lee again.
Cushing and Lee, that's right.
So there again, this is another, you know, little bit of a cash in on the Hammer thing. They made a full-length color film with this, and yeah, definitely they were the kind of cracked to mad scenario for Hammer. And then they followed up with the success of Doctor Who and the Daleks with, you know, taking the second, is it the second Terry Nation? I think it is, Daleks Invasion Earth 21.
I think that's Terry Nation, yeah.
And this one, though, you can... As opposed to the first one, which I think is a pretty-looking film, Daleks Invasion Earth, the budget is really obvious. It's very kind of Corman. Even though it's full color, it kind of has a Roger Corman feel to it, which is they've gone too far with trying to portray this future Earth. It just looks like Daleks Invasion Earth 1966 England.
Yeah, definitely, and a lot of soundstage stuff.
A lot of soundstage stuff. A lot of stuff just filmed in, you know, backlots. When the spaceship lands at the start, you can see the wires. Like, there's still some gems in there, but it's a little bit, it's stretched a little too thin. And I don't they were planning a third Dalek film, and I don't know.
You know, if I'm going to go out on a limb,
yeah.
I'm going to go out on a limb and throw a bit of trivia out, and I could be wrong, but if I'm not mistaken, the actor, Jason Fleming, British actor, Jason Fleming, redhead, kind of freckled, he was in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He was Dr. Jekyll.
Oh, You've seen him
in loads of stuff. I think his father directed one of those movies, or both of those movies, grandfather or something.
Gordon Fleming?
Yeah, I saw. Is that who it is, Gordon
yeah.
Fleming?
Yeah, yeah.
Then that is his father or grandfather. I forget which, but I think it's his dad.
Yeah, it was
a little bit of useless trivia for your next cocktail party.
Yeah, it was a troubled shoot. It didn't get great reviews. They were going to do the chase next. You know, the Doctor Who.
Okay.
I think that's the one that has those big robots in it that Terry Nation was trying to get Daleks again. What are those?
The mechanoids.
Mechanoids, yeah.
Yeah.
They look like patio lanterns.
This will be another winner. Let's get this big round thing. See if we can get it through the door.
You know what always makes me laugh about the mechanoids is that the guy who designed the Daleks got, like, nothing to design the Daleks. Like, he did not get paid, and, you know, Nation became a millionaire overnight. And then, you know,
was
he
it
goes...
Cusick?
And then he wants another robot designed by the BBC, and they just look like trash.
And that's what they come up with.
Yeah,
they did make a figure though. They did make a toy.
Yeah, which came in a
bag or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is just a weird thing when you think about Doctor Who. Like, everything was Dalek. There were a couple of like paint by number things and whatever, but
they were looking for the next big thing. But you know,
right, really right, happy. And they thought it was going to be this round thing. This round
robot. I honestly believe they. whoever was designing stuff at BBC, the nation was a prick at this point, and just here you go, there's your robot. You know,
threw him a beach ball.
Yep, half inflated beach ball.
Yeah.
There you go. So yeah,
so those did well for them. I mean, there couldn't have been massive budgets, but decent sized budgets.
I think it was a get in, get out. I think Invasion Earth was a bit of a dud, and then they went back to horror in 1966 with two films. One's called The Psychopath, and this is, I believe, the first association with psycho writer Robert Bloch. It's not the last.
It's, oh, right.
Yeah. Bloch would end up writing a few of the Amicus productions. I have not...
Boy, talk about staying in your wheelhouse. Talk about staying in your wheelhouse. Hey, we need something, catchy title, like Psycho. The Psycho
thing.
Yeah,
The Psychopath.
How about the Psychopath? Brilliant!
Yeah, well... I doubt Bloch... The Bloch had a lot to do with the titling of the film. He probably wouldn't be too happy with it either.
But I mean, on the poster, it does say from the guy, from the mind of the writer.
Yeah.
He's I think somewhere on that poster. So it's like anything you can get associated with the how massive Psycho was.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? That's what Bloch went to what he could, right? So
right.
It was a popular film though, and again, according to the notes on Wikipedia, which could be right, could be wrong, it was another attempt to cash in on something Hammer was successful at. So you're looking at a lot of Me Too here. Not to say
right.
The stuff doesn't have its own flavor, and I do believe that Amicus did find its own flavor eventually. And then the next film they released in the same year of 1966 is a movie called The Deadly Bees. Have you ever seen this?
I have never seen it.
No, apparently it was a Mystery Science Theater. I don't remember that Mystery Science Theater. I have seen The Deadly Bees.
What haven't they done?
Yeah,
have they done The Godfather yet? Mystery Science, like, have they riff tracks? Have they torn apart?
See, I don't find it tore apart. I find it just kind of fun.
Yeah,
it's another Robert Bloch screenplay. And I've seen this, but it's been so long. And I remember when I first saw it, I thought, this is a terrible Hammer film. But basically, it's about a guy who can, I think, control bees to do his bidding.
You know, as you do.
As I wish I could.
As you do. You've got that skill.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I saw it. I saw it in the early days of having a satellite. It's kind of... I think Sci-Fi Channel used to play it quite a bit.
Clearly that guy wasn't a vegan, because I know vegans that don't eat honey because it's taking the property of the bees, the work that the bees do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So no vegan would put them to work.
No.
And make them do their bidding. So
yeah.
Clearly he was a meat eater.
So I can't recommend. I still find that the company was finding its way with a lot of these films at the time. They in 1967 mm-hmm. they released a film called Torture Garden, and this is
Ooh.
What I believed. It's another portmanteau, and God, I haven't seen this one either.
What the hell is Torture Garden about?
Torture Garden, you know, it stars Jack Palance, Burgess Meredith,
Ooh.
Peter Cushing.
Nice.
It's another one of those things where five people, this time they visit a fairground sideshow. It's run by Dr. Diablo, which is Burgess Meredith. It's one of those things, you know, where they basically tell four stories, you know, the O. Henry type stories, and then the epilogue.
Right.
You realize that that they're, you know, either in hell or that sort of, you know the routine.
Right. Right.
This is another one I've got to watch. Good Lord.
I don't think... I don't even... that may be the first time I've heard about this one. Isn't there one with Tom Baker?
We'll get to that. And actually...
Oh, that's coming.
I apologize, you know, to the audience. I know their films, but I'm surprised at what I don't know by going through this, and that bothers me. I don't like gaps. I love that there are two portmanteau Amicus films that I have not seen, so I'm looking forward to that.
More for you to
Brian,
you to
yes.
eat up.
Yeah. Well,
what about the Is there one with Terrence Stamp? Did Terrence Stamp do a Namekus?
He did, and I'll get to that. And I've seen that. So,
okay.
Yeah, no, that I'm actually looking forward to talking about. But that was 1969, and we're still in, like, 67. Okay. They did a film called Danger Route, which I probably would like to see. You should watch it, too. I know nothing about it except that it's, you know, it's one of those cashing in on the spy genre.
Okay.
You know, James Bond was popular, and everybody made one. I'm pretty sure Hammer made one, too. I think it's called Shatter.
Did Amicus do the ones, the Deadlier Than the Male, the two that were done with, was it Bulldog Drunk? Who the hell was it, the character? But they're really great.
No, I don't think
so. Okay, that's not Amicus.
No. This seems to be Amicus's only venture into the spy genre before they kind of got into something else. And I've never actually heard of this film, so that's another one I got to check out. But it's October, so we'll go to the other ones. Now, the next two for 67 I actually have seen. Amicus did a couple of sci-fis. They Came from Beyond Space is the first one. And this is one where it's like a... They're both not well-received by critics. This one, I believe, is about an invasion, but there's a scientist who's immune because he has a metal plate in his head. And I think they make tinfoil hats to protect themselves from the aliens.
That's where that came from.
Yes, it is. Michael Gow is the master of the moon in this film. And it's been a long time since I've seen They Came From Beyond Space. It's, I'm getting it mixed up with the other one. Because it was, the other film they released that year was called The Terranauts. And the Terranauts spent all their, apparently, they spent all the money on The Terranauts. Although you wouldn't know it. Because it's, the Terranauts... It looks like Star Wars if you and I made it in our basements when we were eight. You know, like I remember watching the Terranauts as a kid going, oh my God, this is infantile. And I think, and I can't, you know, I think They Came from Beyond Space is even less memorable than the Terranauts. The Terranauts was like this. You know, there were space battles and aliens and transporters and laser guns, but it's just so cheese, like so bad. Like, look it up when you get off with me, and you'll see.
It's tough when you want to push the boat out with a sci-fi.
Yeah,
type
movie but you don't. You have
action.
You have a dollar,
but you
and
don't
a half.
Have the money.
Yeah,
you know that's what makes something. You know, the stuff that sort of stayed classic. The things that didn't have money but somehow worked, you know, something like Halloween, when you think about that thing taking place in the daytime and, you know, they couldn't afford extras and how successful it was and how it worked when you didn't have any money, but you're trying to make like a space type thing or, you know, go to other worlds. It's like, you know,
I remember that the reason I've seen the Terranauts and They Came from Beyond Space is because City TV, when I was a teenager, used to have a feature called the Not So Great Movie, meaning they would play they would play garbage, you know. And it really was very influential on a young Brian. I mean, I think I've never quite gotten over the Not So Great Movie, and they played those back to back, and I'll never forget them. I'll never forget anything I watched on there. I even watched like the They would play those, like, you know, The Search for the Real Noah's Ark, those narrated Sun Classics films, and I would just be sitting there watching them, fascinated. But, these are not well... they are not well-received films. In fact, they bombed at the box office, and Amicus didn't make another film for 2 years. And their next film is a, I think it's a drama called A Touch of Love. And the only reason I talk about it is it's directed by Waris Hussein.
Is that the one with, is Sandy Dennett in that?
Yes.
Sandy, and I've
Ian,
never understood
Ian McKellen. And,
Ian McKellen, that's right. Oh, wow. Wait, Waris Hussein directed that?
Yeah. Which is the only thing that really makes it interesting to me is because that guy, of course, has some provenance with Doctor Who.
Wow. I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. The next film they directed is the one with Terrence Stamp, and it's a science fiction drama called The Mind of Mr. Soames. And
okay.
It's actually a pretty good film. I really enjoy it.
It's Robert Vaughn.
Robert
too, right?
Vaughn, yeah. Hot from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or just off The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yep.
And Vaughn started really kind of slumming in the 70s, and a lot of it was in England. But this is not a bad film. It was a failure at the box office. But what the story is about Mr. Soames, a man who has been in a coma since he was a baby. And It's played by Terrence Stamp. I think Terrence Stamp like went off to India not long after this, so he didn't...
he was doing this amazing... This guy was the James Dean of mod... England,
yeah.
Like the movies that he, the stuff he was, but he was the hottest thing around, and he was a sex symbol and all that. And he started working with like Fellini and doing these offbeat things and very low budget things that were more, you know, like I think was it Ken Loach? He did a Ken Loach film. I forget something about to do with a cow. But he started to make these much more off the beaten track stuff, and then right around then, like you said, he disappeared and I think was living in a commune until Superman.
Yeah.
I don't know if he might have done so. No, I think you're right. I think because The Collector was before.
Well, I'm just saying it was around the time he dropped off the face of the earth. Yeah,
I've never seen it. I'd love to see it.
I saw it on television as a kid, and it just kind of there's some good imagery in it, and it has an interesting ending, and it just it's one of those things where you never quite forgot it. It was not a big hit for Amicus. And again, They were, from what I've read, they were trying to get Flowers for Algernon, which I don't know if you've heard about Flowers for Algernon, but it's a very similar kind of story in that I believe it was remade into a film called Charlie. And I think Cliff Robertson played Charlie.
Rather simple.
Right, he was mentally challenged, and then he was given a... Yeah. He was given a serum that made him smarter and smarter until at the end of the story, and I don't want to do spoilers, but if you didn't take grade 10 English, I'm sorry, he becomes more simple at the end. So it's like this kind of, you know, this grace period. And I got to tell you this, and I've got to tell the world this. I was at a thrift shop the other day, and I found this record. Flowers for Algernon, the musical. Starring Michael Crawford, like Condor Man. Some mothers do have him.
What?
And yeah, it's like, who the hell would go see that as a musical? Like, and when was this, and what are the songs? And, you know, I can't believe I didn't buy the LP, because I just...
Yeah, I'm kind of shocked you didn't go home with it.
Well, you know, I kind of thought I was maybe dreaming. Like this weekend I found a Holmes and Yo-Yo... Halloween costume, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna wake up.
I can't believe you found that and you didn't get it, number one. And number two, I saw your little video that you posted.
Oh yeah.
And you had there was a shot of Condor Man
costume. You didn't getting right back to Michael Crawford. Yeah.
You didn't get that either?
I didn't look, I bought the tattoo from Fantasy Island, and I bought
Huge grail.
I bought the Astrea from the Space Sentinels, the Filmation cartoon. I had a very, like, that was, as much as I had a lot of joy running into friends, I ran into my pal Mark Huckabone, I ran into a couple other people I knew before. As much as it was a joy walking around that show and spending 8 solid hours walking and looking at grails, some of it was torture because I had a suitcase. And it turns out a lot of the things I like are big. You know, yeah. G.I. Joe, Quest for the Idol is like, I can't get that home. There was so much Halloween blow-molded stuff that my wife and I love, and it's like, I can't get that home unless I want to get, you know, a long conversation in customs. And my friend who drove me there, Chris, he kept saying, you know, dude, I'll ship anything back to you want. I don't care. And it's like, you know... It's okay, you know. It just And it just becomes like, you know how you go to like an all-you-can-eat buffet and you kind of eat conservatively? That's how I kind of am at toy shows. I like to pick and choose and buy the odd thing, and that's it. And
I figured you'd find some way to either ship back or eventually get Holmes and Yo-Yo and Condor Man costume.
Well,
I would have thought that
tattoo
would have been a couple of grills.
Tattoo was so important to me. That it kind of...
Did you know there was a Holmes and Yo-Yo? Were you aware of this?
I don't know if I was or not.
That is mind-blowing.
I also kept thinking that the minute I tried to buy it, I would just wake up somewhere with a whiskey bottle in my hand and go, of course, you know.
That's got to be one of the top five craziest. Ned Hastings, our pal Ned, who is a big fan of the show, and I'm sure is listening at this moment. I don't know if you saw this picture too, but I know he sent it to me that he found on eBay the Halloween mask of David Burney at Serpico.
Yeah, I haven't been able to verify if that's real or not.
If that's real, that is the greatest. That is the greatest box costume I've
ever
heard of.
Because I've also seen like Al Pacino cruising, and I know that's bullshit.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
I've never seen that, but that's got to be bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's got to be bullshit.
Did I ever mention my cruising story on air?
No, but
my curiosity. It sounds way saucier than it is. there's a review cinema downtown Toronto that plays kung fu movies.
Mm-hmm.
And one Friday night, you know, a couple friends were coming, and my daughter wanted to come. My daughter does like the stuff I do, and you know, she's always been a good sport. She likes horror and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, there's absolutely no downside to bringing her to Kung Fu Fridays. It's always been great. And so, you know, I left a little early from work. I picked her up. I took her out to dinner at a nice patio bar, and then I took her to see, I think it was called Snake Deadly Act. Sitting her down, and they play a 2-minute trailer for Cruising that they've cut themselves. They're going to play Cruising next Friday night. And
oh boy.
I'm like, I'm a tolerant dad. I'm a good dad.
Oh boy.
But nope. And I put my hands over her eyes. And I'm just like, I do not want you to see this. This is not probably going to be great. And it was a very adult, you know, personally cut trailer that was like a minute and a half long. And she was mad. She's getting embarrassed and upset. And she's like, Dad, your hands smell like popcorn. I'm like, I don't care.
Also, let's be honest, not Pacino's finest work.
Not anyone's finest work. And
I think you were trying to protect her from that as well.
Well, you know,
I don't want you to see him like this.
Yeah, I didn't want to see him like that. It was pre-yelling Pacino, but still, I digress.
But still.
It's just not a film I want her to know about. I don't even like the portrayal of it. You know, I don't like anything about it. And I just kind of, I was like, of course, that's the trailer the night I take.
Right.
You know,
right.
My then 10-year-old daughter to a kung fu movie.
That's it's good that you did that, because there are things that happen with our parents that we will never forget, that we will never get back, sort of.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that always makes a kid uncomfortable anyway. I remember, you remember the movie Death Trap?
Yeah, like Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve.
Reeve,
yeah.
And someone else, Diane Cannon, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, spoiler if you haven't seen the movie, but I'm not giving everything away. But
it's like it's a remake of Sleuth, isn't it?
No, I think it was a stage play,
oh,
and then
okay.
They made it into a film. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve kiss.
Oh yeah.
And you know, I was like 10 or 11 years old, and I just remember thinking, oh, this is a really adult movie. Like.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not supposed to be. Not that there's, as a kid, it wasn't like, oh my God, there's two guys. It was like, oh, this is something's going to happen here that I shouldn't see. And to this day, if I ever think about that movie, I think about sitting in the theater and like, I excused myself to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
Because I thought there was going to be some kind of adult scene coming up, and I didn't want to have that memory for the rest of my life.
I would have let her watch 10 minutes of two guys kissing over this cruising trip.
No, exactly. The cruising thing is, I don't know.
Those questions I can answer.
Yeah. I've only seen it once, but it is kind of a terrifying.
It's incredibly dated.
It was dated from out the gate, but it's so, you know. But it just, I mean, this was a major studio movie with a big, you know.
But it's
like,
kind of wrongheadedly portrays.
Everything about it is wrongheaded.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the thing I didn't really like about it either, and. You know, I'm not a fan of it, other than the great SCTV sketch, The Cruising Chef.
Was that Friedkin? Did Friedkin do
William
that?
Friedkin did that, yeah.
William Friedkin, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that was a disaster of a movie.
A friend of mine just, like, loves talking about it because he's just a train wreck guy. You know?
It might be something I'd have to revisit just to see how bad of a train wreck. I don't know anybody else that's in it or anything about it, just that it was just... It was just, you know, like you say, wrongheaded is the perfect word of like
wrongheaded and, you know, and dated the minute it came out. Yeah, and
the minute it came out, and it was that 1980? I think that was maybe.
Yeah, I'm not even sure.
That movie came out.
Yeah. Probably like late 70s, early 80s. Yeah.
Well done that you.
I just thought it was funny, and she was a little embarrassed, but we don't talk about it now, so that's great. All she talks about is how great that kung fu movie was, and
exactly.
Yeah.
Just ignore it.
The next film by Amicus, however, after The Mind of Mr. Soames, is a beautiful return to horror, which and a portmanteau on top of that, and it's one you and I have both seen, thank God, called The House That Dripped Blood.
Yes, let's talk about The House That Dripped Blood.
I love The House That Dripped Blood. I love the poster.
I love it too.
Yeah.
No, I love it. It's fun. But if you want to talk about the height of goofy.
Yeah. It's a bit goofy, and I think the goofiest segment is the one you and I both probably like the best.
Which is the Pertwee one?
The cloak, yep.
Okay, now in the Pertwee one, is the guy... Is that the one that has Ingrid Pitt in it?
It does.
Okay, so not only is Ingrid Pitt in it, who is in Doctor Who...
And she looks hot.
The dude who played Lee Sin Chang is in it.
Wow, that's
British actor.
That is deep.
Okay, he's in it, and his name is Jeff Johnson. No, I'd know it if I saw it.
That's like the dullest name ever. Jeff Johnson. I'm sorry, Jeff.
And Pertwee. And the thing is, the movie came out in '70, so it had to be, and it must have been made quickly. So this might have been right around the time of like
he was the doctor.
The announcement
and he's
was
wearing
made,
a cloak.
Or he was definitely the doctor.
Yeah,
right. He's wearing the cloak, but he does this thing. He does this thing. You and I have talked about it.
Know.
He does this thing in Doctor Who where suddenly he's got a monster wrapping its tentacle around his neck,
or
someone's trying to choke him or something. He does this gurning weird face where his eyes start to cross, and he does it in The House That Dripped Blood, and it is so Carry On. It was it is so. Because he was in a couple of Carry On films.
Yeah,
think,
he was in Carry On. And he was also on Pardon. What is it? On My Way to the Forum. What is that called? A thing happened on the way to the forum.
Yeah,
he has a small bit in that.
So he comes from radio
Spike Jones.
Big broad kind of Spike Jones, and so he does these faces, and there's a moment in The House of Dripped Blood where he just goes full-on cross-eyed,
the worst Doctor Who moment he ever has is in his first, I think it's Spearhead from Space, when the tentacles of the Auton are choking him, and he's really pissing. Like, he's brutal in that. He really diffuses the situation.
Like, what are you
doing?
Yeah,
especially because, it's so Quatermass, that first season. It's all on film. It's all land-based.
Yeah.
It's scary. Yeah. And then, I remember that. I remember seeing Spearhead from Space for the first time and going, like, he kind of...
And also, one of the things about that period for him and why that character was so appealing to him was that he was going to get to act straight
Yeah.
For one of the first time. He was always known as a comedic actor, and so you'd think that he would do everything he could to avoid. He
eventually gets there as the Doctor, obviously. I mean, he's my favorite Doctor, but...
And then he turns right around and does Lords of Gummidge, which is, you know, big, goofy, broad again. It's like the Doctor's the only sort of dramatic kind of thing that he really was known for that he did. So maybe he just had a little bit of cross-eyed stuff left over.
No, there's the first couple seasons. It's four stories. It's based on, like, I didn't know this, but I guess it's based on again scripted by Robert Block. There was a long relationship there, but it's
well, they had him under contract.
I guess so, clearly. But I guess it was based on some sort of weird tales, like 30s, 19 pulp magazines almost, I guess, or anyway, or maybe they're all Block stories. One of the things that's interesting that I didn't know about this film is that Pertwee's part was originally supposed to go to Vincent Price, which makes a lot more sense because it is kind of comedy and he's a horror star.
And Cushing's in it too, isn't he?
He's in the Waxworks episode where they swear they know the Waxwork dummy. They swear they know them. And Cushing, Lee's in one about a private school and forbidding his daughter to have a doll, which is pretty darn good, I remember.
This
is a really
it's
good
kind
one.
Of, it kind of riffs on the Twilight Zone episode. The living doll, the one we made a, you know, Talkie Tina. We made the prop replica. It kind of riffed on
and
that.
Again,
I remember that.
The tie-in is that this is a police inspector looking for the missing film actor Paul Henderson, who's played by John Pertwee, and he contacts the real estate agent, and the real estate agent tells all the dark stories of the house.
That's right.
It's an evening well spent.
And Pertwee is really, he really hands it up as this douchey.
But again, I kind of like that light with the dark, because there's a couple of stories that are really creepy. I think the one with the doll is really creepy. And I kind of enjoy that, actually. The whole idea of, like, you know, it's like you get a sandwich and it's both sweet and salty, you know?
The doll one is very... Well, that to me is the overall kind of appeal of a great anthology show or film. If you look at Twilight Zone, that show could go anywhere. It could go anything in time, space, you know, Western, you name it. And one could be very dark and one could be kind of goofy. And that's what a good anthology, you know, Inside Number 9 is the same way. Some are bigger and more broad than even Black Mirror's got some stuff that's more broad comedically than dark. That's always a good recipe to me, is that you weigh those, and just avoid crossing your eyes.
The next film they made, and maybe you've seen it, I have, is sort of a Jekyll and Hyde remake called I, Monster. Another attempt to kind of cash in on Hamner with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
I'll tell you what comes to mind when I think of I, Monster.
Ozzy Osbourne.
Music. Isn't there a famous kind of, like, did they use a theme from that in Shaun of the Dead or something?
No.
I think if I heard that theme, I'd know it. But I know that that's a cut I have on something. Is I, Monster, I think, unless I'm getting it mixed up with something else. But I'm not sure I've ever seen that.
I have years ago. It was not a hit. It has not... Originally, it wasn't really well critically received, but it is actually kind of a... faithful adaptation of Jekyll and Hyde, without using Jekyll and Hyde. And one of the things I like about the film is it's one of those appearances of, and he's young in it, but Michael Debar. Do you know who Michael Debar is?
Yeah. I sure do. He was a bit of a rock star over in the UK, and then in LA, the LA rock scene. His biggest claim to fame was working with the Power Station when Robert Palmer didn't want to tour, so he took over. I think he might have played Live Aid, if they did Live Aid or something, I forget. But yeah, but he showed up on like WKRP, and he shows up on like Miami Vice and stuff like that.
I think the one I remember him the best from is he's the manager on Seinfeld in the B.O. car episode.
Yeah, that's right. He was the restaurant. Yeah, very big and broad.
Yeah.
And he was in the WKRP episode about the sort of
Scum of the Earth,
new wave kind of punk band. Yeah, come in and destroy the.
He's one of those guys that you like. Every time I bloody well see him, I go, "Who is that again? Why do I know that guy?" And then I have to dig it out, and then I go, "Of course, it's Michael Debar." And I've gotten to the point now where, you know, if I see him in a project, I'll go to my wife, "Oh, Michael Debar," and she'll just like, "I don't know who that is," and it's like, "You shouldn't."
I could be getting this wrong, but his ex-wife is Pamela DeBar, who I think was dating Don Johnson during the Miami Vice thing.
Oh.
I think that was his girl. I think there was something like that, but she was the one that ended up writing that book, like, you know, I'm with the band,
history of being a goofy my whole life.
That's his ex-wife. So she started with him and then became this legendary groupie.
He gets around and I think he may actually, if I'm not mistaken, he may actually host a... Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know if he's actually working on the radio or not. I thought he was at one time.
You know, the last thing I saw him in was a show. I forget if I was in London or here.
Oh, yeah, no, he is. But, he is hosting Michael.
Richard E. Grant did a great show about the most luxurious hotels in the world and what it's like staying in these places. And he comes to L.A. I forget what hotel it was, but Michael DeBar is the one who kind of walks him around the hotel and says, boy, back in the 70s, it was like this here and it was like that over there, you know. And I hadn't seen him in years, and I was like, oh, there he is again. So he I think he lives out in L.A.
Why I know him so well, too, is because, and I just found this out, he hosts a weekday morning show that I listen to every morning on the Underground Garage on Sirius XM.
That's cool.
Dawned on me. Yeah, of course he's a radio host. I hear him all the time. And he's, you know, he plays music he likes, and then he, of course, tells anecdotes, which, you know, only somebody is storied and in the music industry could be as interesting and compelling as he is. So,
whose body was made up, like 60% made of cocaine.
Yeah, I think that's 70. Widely mentioned. So that's iMonster. I would recommend checking out iMonster. It has been a while for me, but it's apparently very, like, as I recall, I enjoyed it very much. And of course, how can you go wrong with Lee and Cushing in a nice color horror film? That's big.
And Michael DeBar.
The next film they became, it was called What Became of Jack and Jill. It's another British horror movie by, you know, this is not written by Robert Block, and that's why it's probably not that memorable. Honestly, I think this is more of a psychological thriller. I have no memory of seeing it, and I'm not sure if it's from what I read here, it was shelved and not released until 1972, so I don't think it was much of a hit for them, and honestly, I've never heard of it. However, in 72, they did release the awesome Asylum. Have you seen Asylum?
Is that the one with Robert,
Powell,
who played Jesus Christ? Robert Powell, yes. Robert Powell and the guy that was in
Clockwork Orange. Wow, you're nailing this.
Patrick McGee, I love that too.
Line out of that movie? Out of Clockwork Orange, he says so robotically. Oh, it's gonna drive me crazy. They used to use it as a soundbite on Opie and Anthony. Never mind. I can't remember.
I remember that. It's a great premise.
I don't want to give it away, but it's. You know, it's an insane asylum instead of a haunted house, and they, what's wrong with this guy? And they tell his story, and what's wrong with this guy?
Right. There's something to do with who's nutty.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
there is a twist. What a shock. I think, you're right. It's just kind of a, there's a twist as to who's running the asylum. You're right. But the one I remember, and you obviously really like, is Frozen Fear, where a guy, I believe, cuts up his wife and puts her into individual parcels in the freezer.
Yes, and she's somebody too. Like, she's a, I mean, well, you know, we're all somebody, but she's a fairly well-known actress.
Yeah, that's the
too,
thing. They got some real names. Her name is Sylvia Sims. I don't know her.
Sylvia Sims.
But you might.
Yeah.
And I think she played Margaret Thatcher.
She just was a staple of, like, British television and films. So they got, I mean, they got these big names. Like, Robert Powell was no slouch even back then. He'd been around and he'd done
stuff. The Patrick McGee line I was looking for was good evening, by the way. The way he says good evening.
And by the way, just side note, because I did cheat and look it up. I Monster is actually the name of a band.
I thought it was an Aussie album.
And they have a track on Shaun of the Dead called The Blue Rap. So
Diary of
Madman. That's, I think, what I'm getting mixed up.
Aussie.
Diary of a Madman.
Why did I
Aussie,
think that? Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, okay, you were right.
It's all rock and roll craziness.
The one I remember also is, because I kind of really dig it, is the Taylor story with Barry Morse and Peter Cushing, where he's a poor tailor who's going to lose his shop, and then Peter Cushing walks in and says, you know, my son's dead. If you can make this witchcraft suit, you can bring him back to life, and I'll pay you, you know, thousands of pounds. And then, of course, it doesn't go well.
Yeah, it never does it? Nobody learned. I always love those ones where there's like a guy, there's always some guy that's a real jerk. You know, there's no heroes in these things, but like the character might be someone that, please, like, you know, I've got these special skills. Like, oh, you're nothing. And then they get cursed, or somehow they come around and get their comeuppance. They make them really big and jerky so that we don't feel so bad.
This one's kind of hard to actually feel bad. Like, you actually feel bad for everybody involved. That story in particular, nobody super duper deserved their comeuppance, I found. Like, poor Peter Cushing is a victim of circumstance, and of course Barry Morse is you know, the fool who plays along, and it's one of those terrible
right.
little everybody just.
So what is that, early
this
70s?
Is 72, yeah,
that one?
And yeah, 72. And you know, I swear to God, I just watched this like 6 months ago and I barely remember it. But the one I remember too is Herbert Lom has these like toys that look like him that are like super creepy.
It's in the, that Mark Gatiss stuff.
Yeah.
I think they show clips and it's so graphic.
Yeah, they got
it's
like
so
organs
weird.
In them and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, really strange. Yeah. Herbert Lom was a big name, too. Like, he'd been around by
76. Oh, yeah, no,
like,
and that's
kind of a
the
name.
Thing they keep saying is they were able to get these established actors because they had this, you know, this beautiful, like, in-and-out policy. Like, hey, it's only going to be, like, a week and a half's work. Why don't you do it? You know?
Right. So yeah, that's the one I want to see the most, to revisit the most.
Yeah, it's really good.
I remember that being really good. What could they did? Amicus, did they go through the? They went up to like the mid-80s, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Kind of? Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. What's next?
Sorry. No. Amicus actually folded in the mid-1970s. I'm sorry. The next.
Oh, I thought they did the. What's the one with the early 80s one with Cushing and Vincent
Cushing,
Price?
Yeah.
And
we'll get into
Monster
the Monster
Club.
That's actually a separate Amicus production. But we're one of the players of Amicus,
okay,
but it's actually not Amicus.
Gotcha.
Okay, so the next film they did was called Tales from the Crypt. And you may remember this because it's based on the 1950s EC Comics. And they actually did just take four issues of the EC Comics and make them into stories. And I think I can remember, honestly, having to drive downtown Toronto to the Manulife Center, which is a kind of a shishi building, to go to this vintage video section of a stereo shop to get a copy of Tales in the Crypt. My friend was just so hot for it, and I knew where to get a copy of it. But this is, you know, mm-hmm. back in the days before Amazon mm-hmm. or anything like that, because he was a Tales in the Crypt collector. And, you know, the VHS of that was not super easy to find. It's really kind of an iconic film. I really like it.
Is that the one that has Tom Baker in it?
It is. No, well, that's not the second one is. This one features Joan Collins. She's in, of course, the Santa, the famous creepy Santa story that started all that genre of murderous Santas. There is a Monkey's Paw story. I would say, and there's one called Blind Alleys where, you know, these guys are, this guy's a real prick to the home for the blind, and of course they get their revenge. You know, it's all that O. Henry stuff. The one I mm-hmm. would say that is the most famous in this one, this is the one, Tales from the Crypt, is the Peter Cushing one, where he is the poor garbage man, or they call it dust man, that lives on the street, Mr. Grimsdyke. You remember this one?
No, but Arthur I love his Grimsdyke? Name.
Yeah, he has Grimsdyke. A bunch of dogs, he entertains children, he's a widower, a lot like Peter Cushing himself, and they just, there's two, like, snobs on the street who just, you know, they get his dogs taken away. They tell the neighbors that he's a pedophile, and they send him nasty letters, and he kills himself. But he's also a little bit into the supernatural. They show him using like a Ouija board at one point, and of course, you know, he comes back to life, and he sends a Valentine's to the neighbors by ripping out the heart of the sun. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I really like that one. And of course, it's again, these guys are on a tourist group to these catacombs, and they're like, why are we here? And then, of course, at the end, they're, you're in hell! Because the crypt keeper.
Well, now
is
I don't need
the,
to see
it. I think the Ralph Richardson is the crypt keeper. Yeah.
Oh. I forgot Ralph Richardson was in that. I gotta find too. That's a pretty big cast.
It is, yeah.
You know? Wait, so what's the one that Baker...
Well, that would be the sequel, which I think happened the year after, because Tales from the Crypt was a big hit. They created the Vault of Horror. You know, because remember...
Vault of Horror, that's good.
Vault of Horror, 2 EC Publications. And... I think, let's see, Vault of Horror, and that's been a while since I've seen this one, but it's very good as well. It's got Terry Thomas in it, which is a favorite of mine.
Yes.
And Tom Baker and Denham Elliott, who'd been in a couple of Amicus productions by this point.
Yes.
Baker's, as I recall, he's an artist, and he uses voodoo in his paintings. Yeah, he's really good in that one, actually.
Yeah. And that was, so that's got to be like 73, maybe?
Yeah.
73, a couple years before he gets the part of the doctor.
Yeah, yep. And, you know?
Yeah, that's a good one. I remember that one.
It's really great. There's one about a killer rope. And the one with Terry Thomas is my favorite, I think, because it's just that typical EC story where he's married a younger woman, like a trophy wife. He's a rich guy, and he marries this trophy wife. Mm-hmm. And he's anal retentive to the point mm-hmm. where, you know, he drives her crazy. And I think mm-hmm. at the end of the film, what happens is she spills something and he's going to come home. And she just has a mental breakdown. And the ending is amazing. You know, she kills him, But she does it very neatly. So that is.
I gotta find that. Is that something that's, because some of these are on DVD, but some aren't, right?
Yeah, I've been able to track a lot of these down. Now, I should point out that, and we just received a lovely care package from our friends at Severn Films that we're just going through right now. Yours are on the way. They are releasing a beautiful 3500 limited edition Amicus Collection Blu-ray with new bonus features that's coming out for December 5th, and I'll put a link up. And it features the pre-forementioned Asylum, and Now the Screaming Starts, The Beast Must Die, and a bonus disc of Amicus trailers. So I'm gonna be all over this. So
especially this. And thank you very much for sending the care package. Wow, how cool
was
that?
It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. I'm still going through that, and we'll talk a little bit about that on the blog as well. But it was very generous.
Yeah, no, it's very generous. Very cool to get a gift like that. So thank you very much. That's the fruits of our labor. We're getting paid back. Nice.
And so after the Vault of Horror, we have a film called And Now the Screaming Starts. And it's another one of those kind of like, it's a gothic horror film. It's got great cast. Peter Cushing, Herbert Lom, Patrick McGee, Stephanie Beecham. And was directed by Roy Ward Baker. I think we both know that name well.
Oh, yeah. Sure we do. Sure we do. Why do I know that name?
Because he directed for Hammer. Dr. Who? You know, Pit, Scars of Dracula. Yes. He directed both Asylum and The Vault of Horror. And my favorite, The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
That's the Kung Fu one, right? Roy Ward Baker. Is there something else we'd know him for? Or is it just
Dr.
those?
Jekyll and Sister Hyde. Oh, mm-hmm. He even directed Moon 02. Oh, okay. My God. Oh, and he directed The Monster Club, which we'll probably end the episode with.
Maybe that's where I'm
I don't know Now the Screaming Starts. Okay. I don't know From Beyond the Grave either. It's another anthology film. What?
Speaking of And Now the Screaming Starts, real quick, there is an episode of Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible that's called And Now the Fearing. That's the title of the episode. And Now the Fearing. So they went deep
with that, yeah.
I mean, like I say, not a lot of those. I mean, only a few of them work, but that one is a great one. I think it's like supposed to be early 70s, and these four or five characters get stuck in a lift, and it's called And Now the Fearing.
It's so funny.
It's very funny. Yeah. I'm going to have to dig that out. I think I have that.
I don't have it. I would like to borrow it.
Well, let me have a look.
Now,
you go ahead.
So the From Beyond the Grave is another. I don't think I've seen this one. Oh yes, I have. It's the portmanteau of it is an antique shop. Peter Cushing is the proprietor.
Oh,
I've seen this. Yeah. I can't for the life of me remember much about it, except it's got Diana Dors in it, who was just gorgeous. I don't know if you know who Diana Dors is.
Yeah, wasn't she married to... did you ever see the Slade film, Slade in Flame, the rock film?
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
So the guy, one of the guys that's in that... Oh, man, someone's gonna hear this conversation right now and go, I know what you're talking about. Diana Dors was married to the slightly younger guy in the mid-70s, and they had these legendary, you know, drug-fueled, alcohol-fueled parties, because they... You know, because he was in a lot of these sort of, like some of those slightly more adult films that kind of hit
Alan Lake
in the 70s. It's Alan Lake, I think.
Yeah. Diana Dors was also married to Richard Dawson. But,
yes, but Diana Dors, Alan Lake, I think. And I saw, what was I watching? Some documentary about, you know, Soho at that time and these adult film things that were sort of changing in that area. And they have a son who is a dead ringer for dad. He's same eyes, same, it's incredible. But they were like kind of a, you know, not, I wouldn't say like a hip couple, but they were Alan Lake and he was in Slade.
The other thing that I remember now about From Beyond the Grave is it stars Angela Pleasance and Donald Pleasance. And Donald Pleasance's daughter looks like Donald Pleasance in a wig. Like, they are the creepiest father and daughter ever. I don't mean that meanly. That's just funny. Mean, like, good
no,
God,
no.
They look
Donald
alike.
Donald Pleasance is a handsome fellow.
Well,
he's a handsome fellow.
There's no way you don't know. And you know, Angela's attractive, which makes it all weirder, you know?
You're suddenly slightly attracted.
Yeah, you're like, what's going on here?
I'm very confused.
To have a long walk and a conversation. I haven't seen this
so
in ages, but wow, I remember this now. And yeah, it's a fairly interesting film. Yeah.
We should really, just for ourselves, just for our own selfishness, we should really start like a video club for each other.
Yeah, we should. We should just send each other DVDs.
I'll send you stuff that you don't have and just like rent them and then keep them for a couple weeks or a month and send them back. And, you know, because truly it's getting to the point where people go, we just look on YouTube. Yeah, YouTube doesn't have a ton of stuff. Well, just because someone put a bootleg of something up doesn't mean, you know, there's Hulu, there's Amazon there. But try to find, you know, try to find The Big Sleep. Try to find something like that streaming. There is nothing. There's no classic movies on Netflix. So a lot of these things we're forced to buy the DVDs because how are we gonna get them? How are we gonna see them?
Exactly.
You know,
the
days of the video store are over.
Full movies on Reddit will help you out a little bit.
Full movies on Reddit?
Yeah, it's a thread, and occasionally you can go through that, and what's beautiful about it is something really odd and obscure will just pop up, and you go, oh my God, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll check that out. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, what's next?
A movie called Madhouse. I'm very upset. I haven't seen this in ages.
I know this movie.
Yeah, it's Vincent Price. And Peter Cushing and Robert Quarry. And Price is playing Paul Toombs, a successful horror actor whose trademark role was Dr. Death, a skull-faced sadist.
I know this movie, yes.
And
Cushing is more timid in this one. He's kind of more, you know, like Price.
He's the writer
Price
of the film.
Someone's having an affair with his wife or something, right? Yes. Okay.
Yeah, and
I barely remember
this one. I really need to revisit it. It seems like I haven't seen it since high school.
I think, you know who's been really great about showing a lot of this stuff has been Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
Every year, you know, every October, they start, you know, every other night or so, they start, you know, running out horror films. They do a lot of the Amicus and Hammer stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes like a double bill of, you know, Christopher Lee Hammer or whatever. I know, you know, there's a few days left by the time this goes up, but check PCM too.
Well, yeah,
stuff.
Actually, I was going to put this
really
up
nice
on Halloween,
job.
So.
never mind. Too late.
So.
You lose.
The next film that I think this is the last Amicus horror is The Beast Must Die. Which I own in a couple different versions because I've picked it up under, like, the title of Black Werewolf, which is the worst name for this film because it kind of gives away who the werewolf is in the film. I don't know if you've seen this.
But it wasn't... Is that the one that had the poster that says one of these people
is
a werewolf?
Yeah, it's totally an Agatha Christie thing, yeah. And there honestly is a version
and
of it.
So that had two titles.
Yeah. And the other title is Black Werewolf, which is just stupid.
That's
kind of removes the mystery. I like the film. It's well made. Apparently, there were 30-second werewolf breaks where the audience is trying to guess the werewolf's identity.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That's kind of cool.
Well, yeah, it's very William Castle.
Like that was a that's a fun kind of gimmick, I suppose. I always thought the dumbest that we're talking about an era here, like the early '70s, late '60s, early '70s, where there were those horror comics, like, you know, Tomb of Dracula and how was it, Frankenstein or House of Frankenstein? The dumbest one was Werewolf by Night, which was just the dumbest name for a comic because, you know, there are a lot of werewolves walking around. Werewolf by tea time.
So then,
not a lot of them walking around.
By the way, the werewolf is portrayed by Calvin Lockhart.
I don't need to see it because you just ruined the mystery.
Ignamic actor. I believe he's the only black guy in the film. So the title Black Werewolf is again just like you're getting what you're getting.
It was originally something, you know, the Beast Must Die, but when did it, like, on home video, it got called back?
I don't know when it got released like that, if it was in a subsequent run, or if it's an alternate version, I remember I had The Beast Must Die. I was at a show, and there was a movie called Black Werewolf, and I'm like, well, gotta own that, because, you know, that's me, and that kind of, that completes the Monster Squad with, you know, Blackula, Blackenstein, and the Watts Monster, which is... Bernie Casey, like, doing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and, you know, then I've got a Wolfman, so...
You just listed, like, four movies that I've never seen or heard of.
You've heard of Blackula.
I don't think. I've heard of Blackula. I've heard of Blackula...
Scream, Blackula, Scream.
Blackula Rises Scream, Again. Blackula, Scream. Scream, Blackula,
and
Scream.
You've heard of Blackenstein. I just saw that recently. You just haven't seen Blackenstein.
I don't know if I've heard of Blackenstein. I don't know if I've heard of it, but now I want to see it desperately.
Yeah, and Doctor, I forget what the Watts Monster's called. It's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but with Bernie Casey. And what the heck is that called? It's basically like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. White, but not really, you know.
Are you thinking of what's the one with Rosie Grier and Ray Milland? What's that one?
It's the incredible two-headed transplant. it's called Dr. Black and Mr. White. Right.
That's a real movie. That's a real movie. Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde.
It's not a real good movie, but it's a movie.
I can remember, like, three in the
morning watching Elvira as a 20-something going, I should be in bed. So they embarked on a three-picture deal towards the end of Amicus with Doug McClure. And I think the one thing that really seems to love this is the Red Dwarf crew. And they not only mentioned it, but actually they've used clips from it in the show a couple of times. Fact, I think... Rimmer's being chased by the monsters from At the Earth's Core in one episode. They actually used the footage. Cheap show it is. The first one they started was Land of the Time Forgotten. I recently watched that one, and I'm an unapologetic Doug McClure fan, and that stars Anthony Ainley as well in a small part. He's the master from Doctor
Who.
He's the U-boat captain.
Yeah, he's the captain. I think
Land of Time Forgotten,
right.
Even though that the dinosaurs are, you know, they're not Harryhausen style dinosaurs by any means. They're kind of hit or miss,
but
it's still a fun movie.
You know what? I loved it as a kid when that thing would come on, because that was ABC Sunday night movie kind of thing. Like that was something that would run not late at night, but like. You know, for the 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock movie, and I just loved.
Do you remember that there was even a Marvel Comics adaptation of that?
No. Wait, is Carolyn Monroe in that? Who's the woman?
She's not in that.
The Carolyn.
She is in the next film we're going to talk about. The woman in that probably be.
Who's the woman in that one?
Susan Penhalgan is the top billed. Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Nope. Wasn't even thinking of her. Never heard of her.
And The next film they made was At the Earth's Core, probably my favorite Amex film of all time.
Is that Cushing again?
And McClure and Carolyn Monroe.
Cushing and McClure.
Takes yes. place in Pellucidar.
Trifecta.
As you know, that's yep. the Earth cut. And yeah, I adore this film. It is a it is what it is. I love the monster films. And it was a popular hit film. And I have nothing bad to say about it. I own it on Blu-ray. And you should too.
Now, yeah, I'm gonna have to get that just for old time's sake, just you know, for nostalgia.
It's a good film.
Cushing's like the
he's Doctor Who in it again,
kind of, and
he's got his mustache going on. So, and then they finished off the series because these were hits. They finished off the series, although the company folded just as they were filming this, so the actual AIP took over. Mm-hmm. The People That Time Forgot, which was a sequel to Land of Time Forgot. I hate this movie. It's just...
Who's in that?
Doug McClure. Patrick Wayne is the star, of course. He was just... I think he was also Sinbad in Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger.
Sinbad. Boy, that guy was a block of wood.
Yeah. Shane Rimmer, your favorite actor, Shane Rimmer's in it.
Greatest actor name ever. Shane Rimmer. No one along the way, no manager, no agent ever came along and said, "Shane, have you thought about changing the name?"
Shane, I was in Hong Kong, and they offer you as a special.
Nobody pulled him aside and said, "Look, dude, I know you love your name and it's a family name and everything, but can we do something?" Anything, you know? No, I love it, and I'm keeping it. Okay, all right. Your funeral.
Shane's first job was announcing Oshawa Generals games, believe it or not, and
Didn't you say that he eventually found out he lived not far from where he used to live or something?
Who was that?
Who was the person that lived a few doors down from you and you didn't realize until after?
Oh, Sidney Newman, creator of Doctor Who.
Sidney Newman. All these near misses.
Yeah, he had like an office on Bloor Street, and I like one day went, "Where was that?" And it's like, "Oh, walking distance from my crummy apartment." You know, not that he would have wanted to talk to me or see me or, you know, have anything to do with me, but, you know, it would have been funny.
Come on.
Amicus folded, but they still, you know, Sabotsky and Rosenberg didn't, obviously, you know, go away. And I think Sabotsky kept it going, and he did a couple of other little films that are kind of interesting. And you know, he had actually the rights to The Incredible Hulk, so he wanted to make a TV movie or a big theater production of that, which never went anywhere.
Oh,
he was the producer.
I don't know if I knew that.
I knew that, but I knew it never, you know, he wanted to make a big budget Hulk movie. He did end up producing the Martian Chronicles TV series, which I like, which one was Charles Freeze production.
That was 1980 or 79 or 80.
He had the foresight to license Stephen King books in the 80s. So he is listed as the producer of Cat's Eye, another portmanteau.
Yes, that was a portmanteau.
Maximum Overdrive, yeah. Sometimes They Come Back, Lawnmower Man, all Milton Sabotsky.
Crap.
Lawnmower all Man crap. Especially.
Total crap.
Crap.
What a big pile of crap
but
that is.
The one film that was kind of that... And we'll just talk about that before we close because I have to pick up my daughter at Girl Guides. Is The Monster Club, directed by Roy Ward Baker. And it's supposed to have Peter Cushing, but he passed. But it does star Vincent Price, John Carradine, and Donald Pleasance.
And that was what, 84? 1982, 83?
And it is...
Oh, that was 1980.
It is super dated. Like, I can remember watching it like 81, 82 going, "This is weird." Because it the Monster Club has bands like UB40 in it, so they're you can tell it's modern.
UB40 are in that. Yes, that's
and,
right.
But
Did UB40 in like the Madness or someone else is in there? Is it just UB40?
All I remember is there's this song and it haunted me ever since I saw her. Just somebody keeps the song is like Monsters Rule, okay, na 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 na. And I never forgot that as a kid, but it it's got a great.
Is that on DVD?
Probably.
Is that like
on I know DVD? It used to be an Elvira release on VHS. That's all I remember is that, you know. That's the way you could get it on VHS is with Elvira, which for me is not a problem, but others maybe that is. It's got Stuart Whitman. It's got some memorable scenes. Again, it's that mixture of horror and goofy. And, you know, there's the Stuart Whitman one, I think, is probably my favorite story because it's about a guy, a movie director, trying to find scout for a town, and he just finds this town of ghouls. And you know, it's just kind of in the middle of nowhere, and that's a fantastic story. And you know, as a Gerry Anderson fan, the cop that picks him up at the end, who turns out to be a ghoul, sorry, is Prentice Hancock, who played Paul Morrow on Space 1999.
Space 1999.
And I think he had several. Like he's in the Ribos operation. He's in Planet of Evil. He's in a couple of really good Tom Bakers. He's a good actor. Yeah.
He got did. Around.
He did get around in the '70s, and apparently he's a really good sport, from what I've heard. So that is the last kind of amicus horror film ever made was The Monster Club, and it was not a hit. It's dated, but it is kind of fun. Like I, you know, now I look at it and I kind of have a laugh with it, but. It's the only, you know, it's the only film that, the only post-amicus horror film, really.
And, oddly enough, back to what you were saying earlier, I've been to Hong Kong, and I got a print of
Hancock
in Hong Kong. So, not only are there Shane Rivers going around, Prentice Hancock is doing pretty well. So, again, might want to change your name, guys.
You might want to change your name.
Might want to.
Guys, so late in your career...
So late in your career, people are finally catching on.
Shane Rimmer, like, he's old in UFO. So,
yeah, he's. I remember him. I was that. We talked about this. I think we were those nerds in the audience for Batman Begins.
Yeah.
And he shows up.
Oh my god!
That's it, Shane. You know, and that had to be because he was in a couple of Bond.
Yeah, films. Yeah.
I know he was in Spy Who Loved
UFO.
Me.
I think they're in the scene together.
Yeah, and that. Is Ed Bishop in Spy Who Loved Me?
Too? Ed Bishop's in he's the opening guy in one of the Bond films where he's the, you know, they're missing a satellite. And he's the NASA guy because it's Rent-A, you know, Ed Bishop was Rent-A-American. Right?
It must have been you only met twice.
Yeah, I think so.
Right?
Yeah,
that must
have
been that one.
Like he is like the opening scene of that film.
The funny thing about him was I could always, his name is so great that it seems like a character from a Gerry Anderson show.
Yeah.
And I used to get him mixed up a lot with what that was his real name. I used to think, he plays that Bishop.
Yeah.
But no, that's his name.
That's a great name.
You know, it's a great name.
And he was a very he was an unappreciated actor. I found the entire cast of that show.
You think Shane Rimmer could look at him and go, "No, that's a name. Yeah. Ed Bishop's a name. I might want to change."
Nobody orders an Ed Bishop in Thailand.
No, not that we're aware of.
That is our amicus story. unfortunately,
there you
go. Bounce, but I think that was an hour and a half of fun. I'd love to know your famous amicus.
About as much as you can stomach.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The one thing I wanted to bring up about Monster Club is that it's the only time Vincent Price ever really played a vampire, except for Muppet Show.
I don't think I knew that. I wasn't sure he ever did. So that's good to. That's good to know. I got to find that. I got to get that on DVD before Halloween if I can.
That's worth it. There's a couple of movies on their way to you too as well. I've got a few I want to review. So maybe we can do a mini-sode and talk about the DVDs we got from Severn.
There you go. I'd love to do that. I am now gonna you go pick up your child and I'm gonna watch. I'm gonna watch Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible and revisit those.
Sounds like a good plan.
And now The Fearing.
Excellent.
I think you can find most of those on YouTube if anybody wants to find those. But it's hit or miss, but it's pretty. There's some pretty good
stuff.
I'm going
to check them out tonight.
Check it out.
Sounds good. All right,
man. Thanks, everybody. Good stuff.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.